Thank you very much, and you are well, all welcome to our meeting. Honorable members, today we are going to do a thought-by-thought deliberation of the bill, the Military Combat Bill. The members will do whatever amendments that you have, and those amendments will be listed on the exhibit so that they should be incorporated in the final version of the bill, which we will attempt to maybe next week on the 14th. We are supposed to do the second reading on the 14th of next week, but we can't do that. And instead, we'll be doing the formal clause-by-clause deliberation on the bill. And I expect members just to submit their amendments today, because when we are going to do the formal clause-by-clause deliberation, we are not going to do any amendments. We would be checking as to whether the amendments that we suggested are incorporated. There will be no new amendment made. Thank you very much, honorable members. We can then go to our bill and start on our short title. If there is any amendment on the short title, Military Combat Bill. I thought that you said the short title would be Military Combat. Military Combat. Honorable Lumia.
Chair, I would propose that we do not change the short title of the bill, and I would base that on the public protector herself recommendation, which if you read in her submission, she says the institution should be known as the Military Ombudsman. There is often a debate regarding the gender appropriateness of ombudsman, but there seems to be general consensus that ombudsman, which in Swedish means people's representative, is gender neutral. That is the recommendation of the public protector herself.
Thank you very much. That is the proposal from Honorable Manier, Honorable Mlambo.
Thank you, Mr. Petit. I disagree because this is my plan. This is not Swedish.
Thank you.
So we need to come up with our own thing as South Africans. I think that if we say Umbat person, it would be far better. Thank you.
Right, what is the trend? What is the trend? Because then this is not the first ombudsman. What is the trend in the banking sector, in other sectors? What do you call the edge?
You can address it.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. Ombuds would be acceptable. It's been used before. In other roles, legislation.
Can we just take the consistency and say Umbat? Military Umbat. Like banking Umbat and so on. Thank you very much.
Then we go to the
clause one. Any amendment on clause one? A. Honorable Menia.
I presume that you're leaving the bold text under bill on page on the bill until last or not? Chair, I would propose an amendment to the long title. The amendment I would propose is to delete "to provide for the establishment of the Office of the Military Ombudsman," and I would propose that we insert "to provide for the establishment of an independent Office of the Military Ombudsman."
That we insert "independent." Suggestion that we insert "independent" military honorable Gabanelli.
I don't think it could make any dramatic change. You can take it.
Okay. Second. Independent. Have you ever heard of a military ombudsman who is not independent?
Yes, I have, Chair. The ombudsman as provided for in this bill is not independent, as based on the legal opinion of the Parliament.
Okay. Thank you very much. That is taken. Then we'll go to definitions. Definitions. Clause one.
Hey.
Thank you, Chair. I wish to propose an amendment to the definition of complaint, and members of the committee will know that the definition of a complaint is an important definition because to a large extent it defines the scope of the mandate of the military ombudsman. So I would propose that we delete the definition of complaint and replace it with a definition which reads as follows. Complaint means a grievance lodged in writing by a member regarding his or her conditions of service. I delete service benefits and I use the term conditions of service, which is the term consistent with the term we used in the Defense Amendment bill and will be defined in that bill, and because of the amendment ought to be now be defined in the Defense Act. So I use the term conditions of service. Chair, just to repeat, A member regarding his or her conditions of service. B, a former member regarding his or her conditions of service. C, an employee regarding his or her employment practice. D, a former employee regarding his or her employment practice. Chair, just to step back, I include C and D to ensure that the military ombuds person would still be obliged to investigate complaints that emanate from employees of the Department of Defense who are part of the civilian component of the Department of Defense. I then go on to include E, a member of an auxiliary service regarding his or her conditions of service, a former member of an auxiliary service regarding his or her conditions of service. I include that so that the military ombudsman would be required to investigate complaints of members of the auxiliary services employed by the Department of Defense. I include G, an immediate family member of persons referred to in A, B, C, D, and E above, or H, a member of the public regarding the conduct of a member of the Defense Force. Thank you, Chair.
Let's start with your A. Can we start with your A and look into that A? What is it? Read it again, Honorable Mimia.
A, read.
Hello. Go on.
A reads, a member regarding his or her conditions of service. That is consistent with A in the draft bill, save for the use of the term conditions of service.
That we insert a member regarding his or her conditions of service. Put in conditions of service.
Chair, we may want to just simply take a look at the definition of conditions of service in the Amendment Act. I looked at the definition last night. Members will recall that it's a fairly broad definition, but I thought that we would be better advised to use that term because it is defined in the existing Act.
Honourable Bandir.
No, Chairperson, thank you. I suppose Honourable Mayor must have listed this amendment somewhere, if he can circulate them so that we put our mind on them properly, because we are not able to.
No, but the question is that there is a proposal on A that we should insert conditions of service.
Chairperson, I said yes, we did hear what he's proposing.
Okay.
But we want to put our mind on it.
Chair, I apologize. It's in fact an omission on my part. I ought to have given my amendments to the Secretary. I did not do so, and I apologize. I do have two copies here. One for the Secretary, and we can at least give one to the Honourable Monsieur.
Okay. Just make copies for all members. Are we agreed on inserting conditions of service? Honourable Daniel.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, sir, I think because you just said service benefits is restrictive. So if we are holistically talking to conditions of service, it's inclusive. I think we'll take that, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Daniel. Conditions of service. Then can we then go to B? Same conditions of service. Okay. C, see. Honorable Minister.
Chair, the motivation for my proposal is, honorable members will know that there are large numbers of civilians who are employed by the Department of Defense. They are integral to they hold important positions, and they are integral to the functioning of the Department of Defense, and are valued members of the department. And it would seem to me that if they do have grievances, those grievances remain unresolved, they should have an opportunity for the military ombudsman to investigate their complaint. I use the term there, employment practice, because again, if I recall correctly, the term employment practice is used in the Public Administration Act, and I stand under correction.
Hello, we are on C. What are your intro now?
I'm talking to C.
What is your position? What you propose on C?
C chair reads, an employee regarding his or her employment practice.
No. Look, you see, currently reads as a member of the public regarding the conduct of a member of the defense. Yeah, that's how it reads now. Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's what I want us to look into. Okay. The only suggestion that you should have maybe is that a member of the public regarding the official conduct of a member of the defense, because you run a risk of dealing with the domestic violence at home and so on. Mm. Okay, Honorable
Minister. Chair, that's an interesting suggestion. Would that preclude, for example, a case where a military officer who was not on a military base, who was in, for example, civilian attire, and who outside working hours, for example, harassed civilians or committed some kind of offence, would this then exclude the military ombudsman from looking into that case? And if it does, is that a good idea?
Honourable Daniel?
Thank you, Chair. In that case, Chair, that is a civilian, because that particular person is not in uniform, is not on an official duty, and there is the police to deal with that matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And then we then go on. We are done with C. Oh, Honorable Gavadeli.
Yeah, I'm coming with
C. Okay.
You can expand, extend the definition and include a complaint. Before, let me motivate why this complaint has to come in. You are saying why this person in the past to come from the present is disadvantaged. Not everybody will sleep and wake up tomorrow knowing everything. So I'm motivating them to include the complaint lodged by a third party on behalf of a member.
A person acting on behalf of another member. Mm-hmm. That's what we want to do. Another section.
Yeah.
Okay. How will it read? A complaint means a grievance lodged in writing by a person acting on behalf of another member. Agreed? Which means that will be G. Okay. Thank you.
I'm sorry, I came late. My name is Bongi, was from the office.
opportunity my advisor, I'm just going to respond to what it says right now. The edition is a person acting on behalf of another man. Why can't it be a person acting on behalf of a member? What if you say on behalf of another, we say they've imposed that person of a member. So it's just a person acting on behalf of a member.
A person acting on behalf of a member. That would be our team. Any other thing on this mission? Honorable Mayor?
Chair, as you know, proposed quite a detailed amendment to the definition of complaint, and we do not seem yet to have considered my definition in respect of employees, auxiliary members, and family members.
Can we check and chair about members, civilian members that are working in the defense? Is there any process for them to launch a complex? That is one. Number two, auxiliary and all of other chair. It's not a country. We're not bringing that debate here. We're talking about an almost, not really part of the policy. And I just wanted also to check. Don't we have something that deals with such complaints in the military veterans bill that deal with complaints of the military veterans? Because if you're saying a former member, now you're talking about a military veteran. I don't know. It's a question.
Before I'll give you the opportunity to respond, you want to make a follow-up, Honorable Mayor?
Yes, sir.
Just a point of fact, Chair, and in fact it's not a point of order. Members of auxiliary services are not military veterans. Members of the auxiliary services are members of the auxiliary services. And I mean, in addition, it might be helpful if the department could clarify exactly who auxiliary members are, and perhaps when you understand what services they provide in the Defence Force, you may well reconsider your position. But auxiliary service members are not military veterans.
Fine. Can we get a response from the department? Jigala?
Thank you, Chair. I will just speak to two issues, the issue of employees and of veterans, which I think may present us with some challenges. If you look at the employees, Chair, within the Department of Defense, now I think one should always bear in mind, why are we at this point? We are at this point because there is growing appreciation within the defense environment that the Defense Force is a unique organization. Therefore, we need to find unique solutions for it. Now, the danger with bringing employees under this dispensation is that there is already an existing dispensation, which is the Public Service Commission. If I have a grievance and the department has not been able to solve that grievance within its own internal procedure, I am entitled to approach the Public Service Commission, which is a structure that is created to attend to grievances by public service employees. But now the realization is that these kind of structures which are intended for the general public service, in many instances are not suitable to attend to the unique circumstances of the defense force. Hence the creation of a unique structure like this. Now if you bring in those employees within the defense force, you are creating parallel structures. In other words, I will have a choice, either to go to the public service commission or go to the military home. So I think it may be a very uncomfortable thing to manage in practice, but most we know where we're supposed to go in the public sector to deal with our own community. On the issue of auxiliary services, Chair, it's a difficult question for me to answer. As far as I know, we no longer have auxiliary services within the force. But I think there may be a case to be made for former auxiliary services in respect, I think it was your proposal and the Dr. E. But the Defense Force no longer has auxiliary service as of now. But in the past, there were auxiliary service. So I think there may be former members who may have issues. I don't know to what extent those people are still alive and still have grievances that they still need to be attended. But you will notice that I think even in the Defense Act, there is a specific provision that deals with auxiliary service. Now that was 2002. Well, it speaks to auxiliary service, but in the department we see there seems to be a general understanding that we no longer have auxiliary service within the Defense Force, because all those kinds of functions have since been outsourced and they have been done by private companies to the Defense Force. But there may be former who may have grievances that are still outstanding that we need to be attended.
Thank you. Agreed, Honorable Minister.
Chair, the response in respect of employees, I think, is compelling, and I think we should possibly reconsider that and delete or not consider my proposal for C and D. I'm still a little bit concerned about auxiliary services for two reasons. The first is that the Defence Act does provide for three reasons. The first is we are unsure about whether we still have auxiliary services. That's a point of fact which needs to be clarified. Second, the Defence Act still provides for auxiliary services. Third, there may be former members of the auxiliary services who have grievances. And third, I can see the Honourable Daniels is becoming very irritated with this point. But let me tell you exactly who the auxiliary services were many years ago. The Defence Force employed members as gate guards, riggers, etc. in the Navy. I'm not so sure why you're so eager to wipe out and disregard those members' grievances.
Honorable Cavadelli.
Thank you, Chair. The department is here. Can they tell us whether they're still doing according to many years ago? What is there now? Because that's what Honorable Daniels is talking about. Not about many years ago. Otherwise, Chair, we'll be going back to the past unnecessarily. What is happening now is what Honorable Daniels was asking. Let the department tell us whether he's still there or not.
But the department says they do not have auxiliary services anymore. Now, the question that we must look into now is as to whether the auxiliary services that exist now, can they still be covered by the bill to complain to the ombuds? I think that should be the question. Department, you want to...
Chair, you see, the point is, when the service was done away with, you'll find most of the people who served in the auxiliary were civilians, but within the Defense Force. So when the new dispensation came, most of those people were assumed as ordinary public service and personnel within the Defense Force. But I think the difficulty is, I'm not sure legally, I haven't really applied my mind to this. If a person may have a grievance that relates to his period before the change to a dispensation, whether that grievance can be dealt with in terms of the normal public service commission regulation. That's the difficulty which I will need, because that would basically mean it applies retrospectively to something that happened in a different dispensation. I think that's something we need to really reflect on and see how we can deal with it.
Honorable Daniel.
Thank you, sir. Chair, I think what the legal person is saying, Chair, that is a continuation from a civilian to that period in time and going back to his or her work. And that's a continuation. And that testing is not part of the defense. So really, we cannot give that responsibility to the ombuds person to be dealing with that now, because that person is continuing somewhere else, Chair. Thanks.
Honorable Mania, Honorable Blanco, you follow?
Chair, I would propose that we ask the department's legal advisor to apply their minds to this issue, and that we perhaps flag this proposed amendment and come back to it later when the legal advisors have had an opportunity to apply their minds. there are two issues that they will have to consider. The one is the question of whether there are former members of the auxiliary services who may have grievances. And in fact, I have dealt with a grievance of a former member of the auxiliary services. That would be one question, the retrospective part. But so long as the Defence Act provides for auxiliary services, there's nothing that would preclude the minister from appointing members of the auxiliary services going forward. And we need to be sure in our minds that there is a mechanism that they can use to lodge grievances and to have those grievances investigated, be that through the military ombudsman or through the Public Service Commission. But I don't think that we should just disregard the auxiliary services and former members of the auxiliary services.
Proposal, Honorable Mazia.
Yes, Chairperson, I sympathize with Honorable Mayor. However, Chairperson, I think it will not be correct for us to open the ombudsman to an extent where the ombudsman will not be able to do his or her work because of other matters that are not military related and not unique as it is described in the establishment of the ombudsman. Because we should also take it from the point that what necessitated this establishment of this office is not necessarily because of ordinary workers of the defense. It is because of members of the defense. And if we all understand it in that format, I think we will understand the workload that will be occupying that office. And I want to plead through you, Chairperson, with Honorable Minister, that we don't open it to the extent that we will also not realize what is the key intention of the establishment of this office.
Thank you very much. Did the department want to respond to anything?
Chair, it's a very complicated question, and I think we need to accept that, and we'll need time to reflect, because it's not only the issue of auxiliary service. We were just talking now, within the Defence Force, for instance, there are finance functionaries who were previously in the military, but when the Secretariat was established, because the function migrated to the Secretariat, they demilitarized. But when you look at the benefits, they still retain the military benefits. So I think it's something that we really need to apply our mind. Maybe on the 14th, when you start your clause-by-clause deliberation, we can come with a kind of a concrete response to the proposal. Thank you,
Can we settle with that? Thank you very much. Any other thing?
Nothing.
Yeah, under complaint. Under definition, you're right. Honorable Matano?
Chairperson, that one is not there. It's the immediate family who will be complaining on behalf of the members.
An immediate family member will be complaining on behalf.
I thought when I raised that point, it was inclusive of the point. When I raised the point of include complaints lodged by the party on behalf of a member.
Okay.
We just raised that point because, interestingly, in the 2006 bill, it provided for a very similar clause. But I think it is covered by the Honourable Nkrumah's proposal. I don't want to feel that our deliberations are being rushed. This is a very important bill. We need to get it right.
That does not seem to do with what you're saying. The matter has been settled. We'll go back to it. Okay. Honorable members, do we have any other thing on complaint? Okay. We go to the constitution there.
Chair, prior to constitution, we would propose that we include a definition of conditions of service, and the definition reads, conditions of service, there's the same meaning ascribed to it in section 1 of the Defence Act, Act number 42 of 2002. I just want to be clear with the law advisors. I mean, we've amended the Defence Act. There is a definition in the Defence Amendment Act referring to conditions of service, and I believe that that would then obviously mean that it is captured, the amendment is captured under Section 1 of the Defence Act, and this correctly captures the definition. The closest I ever got to law school was the coffee shop, so I just wanted to check.
Do you need to respond to that?
No, Chair. I think the definition is in the Defence Amendment.
Okay. That's fine. Then can we move to Constitution? Agreed?
Mm-hmm.
Defence Force? Agreed?
Mm-hmm.
Department? Department.
On Defence Force,
yes.
Chair, just to say that we, once the legal advisors have briefed us on the question of the employees in the finance division and the auxiliary division, we might need to revisit our definition of Defence Force, because I think Section 11 refers only to the military component. It's just an issue, I think, something that we should flag.
Okay. The department? Agreed. Deputy Ombudsman?
Deputy Ombudsman.
Which means it will change the subsequent line, means of the office of the military ombudsman. Okay. Member? Done. Agreed. Minister? Agreed. Office? Office means the office of the military ombudsman, right? Consistency. Then ombudsman, which will be ombudsman, means the military ombudsman again. Then we are going to clause 2. Office of Military Ombuds, then check it. Honorable Minister?
Chair, just on clause 1, again, depending on the advice that we received from the department, we may need to insert a definition of employee and employment practice. I've captured both those definitions in my amendments.
Where do we include that? Where do we
Chair, I simply point out that depending on the legal advice we receive, we may need to include a definition of employee or employment and employment practice.
I think we need to clarify this. The military ombud deals with the South African National Defence Force, the uniformed component of the department, who has a unique position and therefore has a specific grievance system falling under a military justice system. All this excludes civilians. Civilians in the Department of Defence have their own dispensation, like any other public service. Now, when we say there is confusion with the final, well, not confusion is the wrong word, there are areas of complexity with the finance functionaries. What happened was, as Jikela said, when the finance function moved from the SANDF to the Defence Secretariat, it was negotiated that the finance functionaries would retain their benefits, because the benefits accruing to military personnel are different to those accruing to civilians. That's the only reason that it's become complex. But today, a member of the finance section has the same rights and duties and privileges as any other civilian in the Department of Defense. We're just saying that this was one of the results of the transformation. So now to bring in employees actually undermines the whole issue of the military ombud. The military ombud is part of the grievance system that belongs to the uniformed members of the Department of Defense, specifically. And it's going to create a myriad of problems if we now say, no, it applies to everybody. Because everybody has a different system.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm not sure as to whether we should just go on talking about this. Honorable Mlambo.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. I think we'll be around in circles. Honorable Maynard, I think my understanding of the word military, it says a lot. It means a person who is in uniform. You asked a question before to say if a member of the SANDF is involved in criminal activity wearing civilian clothes, and that was answered. The bill simply means military ombuds, person or ombuds, so to speak. So we deal with military issues specifically. Thank you.
Honorable
Minister. Chair, one of the debates we're going to have, and it will be triggered by several clauses in this bill, is what exactly is, if you like, the scope of work of the military ombudsman. Now, the model that Parliament used prior to 2006 was the Canadian model, and the Canadian military ombudsman deals with complaints from uniformed members and employees.
Chairperson. I understand and want to caution that not too much description of a responsibility. Sometimes it's not healthy. I don't think that the ombuds person we are talking about is going to be an ignorant person. Though we are saying here we are talking about a military ombuds person, but we think that that person will not just close ears and ignore even reasonable requirements put before him or her. Now, when we begin to be too prescriptive, I think it is going to cause both ourselves here, and it is also going to put a lot of burden to the person that we expect to do a particular work for the department. Now, unless we are persuaded otherwise, that yes, there is a need for us to take into consideration this other section and to have that section in definition, then maybe we will be convinced. But, Chairperson, I do not find where we should conclude to argue on this point, except to say that we all know why we want the ombudsperson in the defense. But at no stage was there a matter that was presented to us that the department in total requires this person. All we know is that this person is wanted in the defense for purposes of uniformed officers. And I think if we leave it at that, Chairperson, it will assist us.
Okay, let's leave it at that. Then we go to, I was already on clause 2, Office of Military Ombudsman. That will start to be Office of Military Ombuds. And then the section 1 on clause 2. Just for consistency, it will be Military Ombuds. And section 2. Consistency again, military ombuds. Can we go to clause 3, object of office? Honorable Daniel? that if there's no any other input on it, we pass it.
What do you mean by that?
You say they should, the honorable members should consider it as per the advice of parliamentary legal advice.
Can you sleep over it, Chair? We'll come back to you.
Sleep over it. Ma'am?
Mr. President, I understand the issue. Usually when you talk of the offset of act, those offsets are already contained in the long title to the day. You know, you don't provide for the long title and also provide for the offset. What is in the long title is already contained in the offset. So perhaps we could work on the long title so as to make it clear what is the objective of the act. What is proposed there, we could work on it in the long title.
Okay. Can we put it in the long title? Can we work it in the long title?
Chair, I would prefer it to be in the as I proposed, to capture particularly that our intention is to provide for an independent military ombudsman, and that the purpose is to ensure that all matters are investigated in an impartial, fair, and expeditious manner. I would prefer it captured in the law itself. I've just spent a year and a half dealing with the Protection of Information Bill, and we have a very clear object of the Act in that bill, and I think it very nicely sets out what it is we're trying to achieve.
But I thought that was the you're advising on the legal format of a bill, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's follow the format. The law advisor is wrong.
Yes.
If you look at the Protection of State Information Bill, there is a long title and there is an object of a clause dealing with the objects of the Act.
Who's a lawyer and who's a lawmaker here? I need to know now. I don't know who am I speaking to. We want consistency. Whatever, whether you are wrong or not wrong, we want a consistent format. Whatever you work out on, it will be a consistent format.
I suppose I wanted to say it is the prerogative of the committee. If you want to put it in the act, it's fine. You know, it is your office. You can do with it as you please. Thank you.
Honourable Kalagel?
Chair, can I request Honourable Manning to write that so that when you say you are sleeping over it, why not sleeping over something that comes from the mouth? That's something that is written down.
It is in the copies that you will receive, right?
No, from him?
Yeah.
Yeah, this.
I haven't received any copies.
The copies have been made.
Who has the copies?
Mm-hmm. I think Honourable Kalagel is right. I did apologize. I should have got my amendment to the committee secretary earlier. I think the Honourable Nazir may have a copy, but the Honourable Mkhlab Daly is right, she does not have a copy.
Honourable
Daly?
Honourable Daly?
Chair, I just want to check. Can we say something in the long title and not do it? Actually, when we do the act, I just want to check. Because to me, it does not make sense. Because if you're saying that in the long title, it means that is what you're set out to do. At the end of the day.
We need to be clear as to what is our debate here. Are we debating about the format, or are we debating about the content of what Honorable Meunier just suggested or proposed now?
Chairperson, I just want to clarify this. There is no harm in putting the contours of the offset of the act in the act if you so wish. There's no right, there's no wrong in doing that. You know, if you want to put it in the long title, it's fine. If you want to put it in the board of the act itself, it's fine. That can be done.
Okay. Can we really just waste our time on the format? If we agree with the content, let it go on. That's it. Okay, fine. Then can we go on, honorable members, to the We're still on clause. Oh, that was clause 3, eh? Then we go to complaint 4. Section 1. Honorable Minister.
Chair, I wanted to propose that clause 4 be deleted and be replaced with a section dealing with the mandate or the functions of the Office of the Military Ombudsman. I just want to be clear before I set out my proposal that the section 4, which I propose deleting, I do propose capturing those words in a different section of the bill. So we do not lose those words. I'm proposing that we delete them and insert them in a different section of the bill. Now, members will remember that Parliament's law advisers advised in several sections of their legal opinion that we as a committee apply our minds to the mandate of the committee to function and set it out clearly in law. So let me then set out my proposal to you, Chair.
Yes.
Okay. I propose that the new clause 4 reads as follows. For sub-clause 1, the military ombudsman is competent to investigate on his or her own initiative or on receipt of a complaint any alleged A, maladministration in the Defence Force, B, abuse of power by a member of the Defence Force, C, unfair, improper or dishonest conduct, an act or an omission which results in an unlawful or improper prejudice to any member of the Defence Force, D, improper or unlawful enrichment or receipt of any improper advantage or promise of such enrichment or advantage by a member of the Defence Force. 4.2, the military ombudsman must investigate complaints lodged by a member or a former member regarding his or her service, her conditions of service, complaints lodged by any employee or former employee regarding his or her employment practice, complaints lodged by an auxiliary service member or a former auxiliary service member regarding his or her conditions of service, complaints lodged by immediate family members of persons referred to in A, B, and C above, complaints launched by a member of the public regarding the conduct of a member of the Defence Force, any matter, this is important, any matter referred to the Ombudsman by the President, the Minister, or a Member of Parliament. 3, the Military Ombudsman may, after advising the President, the Minister, and the Joint Standing Committee on Defence, in writing, investigate any other matter relating to the Defence Force. Then 4, I then go on to say the military ombudsman may not investigate a complaint relating to, and I capture then the entire clause 7 of the bill dealing with the limits of jurisdiction. So what I'm proposing is that we as a committee, based on the advice of Parliament's legal advisers, set out a new clause where we clearly set out the mandate of the military ombudsman. And we say both what the military ombudsman may do and what the military ombudsman may not do in a new clause 4. Now, there are two areas which I would obviously ask the committee to agree. The one would be for the general proposal that we include a clause 4 dealing with the mandate of the military ombudsman, and then of course I have a proposal for that mandate. Clause 4, proposal
that the it should deal with the mandate of the military owner. Clause 4. We have complained. Honorable Daniel? Honorable Kavadeli will follow. Lambo?
Thank you, Chair. I had a long list of the things on 4.1. What are the conditions of service? If we are going to include other things, because remember, this bill is going to deal with those conditions of service, of uniform members. On the 2, the President, a member of Parliament. Are we members of Parliament? Are we not citizens? Are we not citizens on behalf of the members? What do we want to do exactly with this thing? Maybe I need to be enlightened. So, as members of Parliament, it is not enough that we're doing oversight on the department and all of these. We also want to tell what the ombudsman must do. I just don't understand it. Because the members are given an opportunity to launch complaints with the ombudsman. So how do we get to launch complaints for people to the ombudsman? How and when does it get to the, where do we draw the line? We are doing our business. We do oversight as lawmakers, that citizens must be able to take it forward, to launch complaints to the ombudsman. How do we get to tell the ombudsman to do things for members or those that we think or we feel that they need to be listened to by the ombudsman? Doesn't the bill give enough rights to these individuals, uniform members, to launch these complaints? And then on the auxiliary, I thought we agreed that is an issue to be dealt with before we can even talk about it now. Thank you, Chair.
And the matter on employee, I think it has...
The matter
on employee, Honorable Menia, I think it has been settled there. Yeah, we don't talk about it. Honorable Kavadeli, Honorable Mambo.
Thank you, Chair. Auxiliary, I'm covered. But I wanted to find out from us, do we want to have a topic that talk about the money? Because it's not there, so that you get advice from the law advisor. It's not there. Do we want, so that you take it step by step? It's too much, and we are just receiving the document now.
Yeah.
And secondly, do we want to do away, Honorable Menes, do you want to do away with complaints altogether? If not, then let's flag what the input from Honorable Menes is in charge of this document. But from the chair, I wanted to know whether we do want to have a heading that says money. Because we don't have it.
I think that is the question. That is our point of discussion now. Jigela, you will come. Honorable Mlambo.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. There is a section here which deals with powers and functions of the ombudsman and the deputy ombudsman. So I think we haven't reached that stage. So honestly, I think you must jump ahead into another point that's coming up. Because we do have powers and functions on the bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Jigala, you wanted to give guidance.
Yeah.
We expect legal advisors to give advice from time to time on matters of technical matters. Honorable, stand together. Honorable advocate.
Yeah, I was going to suggest something similar to what Honorable Mlambo just mentioned. It's becoming extremely difficult for us to catch up in the manner in which we're dealing with it. I was going to suggest that maybe we follow the structure of the bill as it is, and we make proposals, because there is a specific provision that deals with powers and functions of the ombudsman or the ombuds. It seems to me what is being proposed now will fit in very well within that, and it can be deliberated when we get to that point which deals with functions. But if you propose it, because as I understand, there seems to be no objection to what is under complaint, but somebody would prefer that it be expanded on. But there is a provision that deals with that. But if we keep on chopping and changing, we lose the structure of the bill. That's what I was going to suggest, Chair, that these issues should be raised under the relevant headings of the bill so that we can expand there is a need to do so.
Can we then follow the Ministry's trend, Honorable Minister? We are agreed on four. Section 1, Section 2. Honorable Mayor.
Chair, then that's how you'd like to run the deliberation. I think that the Clause 4, I would still argue, ought to be deleted and incorporated under the Powers and Functions section, because the Powers and Functions section really strike me as a section dealing with less with the powers and less with the functions.
Honorable Mayor. Right, I'm flagging it. When we talk about the powers and functions, we'll come back to it. Let's flag it. Okay. You want to say something?
I understand, Mr. Chairman. Perhaps we can revisit what is proposed, by the Honourable Mayor, because it is also important to set out clearly what is the mandate of this body that we are creating, from the beginning. And then in the functions, you elaborate, you go into detail.
Yeah, I think
that we need to revisit this and also redraft it. We need to work it out, what is proposed in front of the committee. But in terms of the structure, there is nothing wrong with setting it out in the case. That would be the mandate of the committee.
Right, I think that's the
Can we then go to the appointment of military ombudsman and deputy military ombudsman, that is clause 5, and then the consistency there, military ombuds, and deputy military ombuds.
Thank you.
No, that document is. These are the proposals by Honorable Mayor.
But you look at each page, one, it's the same thing.
No, it's fine. It's not your document.
So where are the proposals beginning?
We are now on plus 5, Honorable Gabadi.
I know what I'm understood. Where are the proposals here? And where is the difference between what we have and what has been distributed?
So first, you explain the document.
If I could just refer to the Honourable Mclovedilly to the title page of the document. At the bottom of the title page, you will see draft 1, DA proposals for amendments to the Military Ombudsman Bill. And then if I take you to, for example, page 1 of the document, my insertions are underlined, and my deletions are in brackets.
Bold letters, sorry.
As the case may be, my deletions are in bold and in brackets.
That's fine. Then can we go to clause 5? Honorable Labo?
I propose that on clause 5.1, we put the parliament. We say the parliament must appoint the military ombuds. Yeah. Thank you.
The proposal that on section 1, instead of the president, we said the parliament must appoint as a military ombuds a person. Is that what you're talking about?
Honorable Azia? Yeah, no, I suspect that Honorable Mlambo wants to question the role of Parliament in the appointment of the establishment of the ombudsman. Maybe we can find the wording around that intention, but here on the appointment, there is nothing said about the role of Parliament except of the President, and it is normal practice that Parliament has to have a role in this establishment.
Nice. But how do you, Honorable Benia?
Chair, I would infer from what the Honorable Flamber and the Honorable Mathia say that there is, and this would be again consistent with the view of Parliament's Lord Advisors, that Parliament should play a role in the appointment of the military ombudsman. The question then is how? Do you have a proposed amendment which I think gives effect to this and which I hope that the ruling party will consider. It essentially amounts to the President appointing the military ombudsman based on a list of five persons which he would receive from the National Assembly. So my proposal through you, Chair, reads as follows. Do you regard having been given to a participation by the public in the nomination process, transparency and openness, and see publication of a short list of candidates for appointment? The Joint Standing Committee on Defence must table a list of five persons for approval by the National Assembly. The National Assembly must, by resolution, with the support of a majority vote of its members upon approval, submit the list of five persons to the President for appointment.
Thank you very much. That is the proposal as to how it should be captured. Honourable member, Honourable Daniel.
I'm not finished.
Oh, yes.
I suppose this is a lawyerly way of saying that the President appoints the military ombudsman, and the appointment must be made from a list of five names furnished to him by the National Assembly. But I do then have a qualifier, say that the ombudsman must possess adequate knowledge of the Constitution and have a legal qualification and practical legal experience of at least 10 years. I go on, Chair, to say that a person may not be appointed as a military ombudsman or deputy military ombudsman if he or she is not a citizen of the Republic, is appointed by or is in the service of the state and receives remuneration for that appointment or service, is a member or a former member of the Defence Force, is a member of Parliament, any provincial legislature or any municipal council, is an office bearer or employee of any party, movement or organisation of a political nature, is an unrehabilitated insolvent, has been declared to be of unsound mind by a court of the public, has been convicted of an offence in the Republic other than an offence committed prior to 10 May 1994, associated with political objectives, and was sentenced to imprisonment without an option of a fine, or has been removed from an office of trust on account of misconduct involving theft or fraud. Chair, these are in fact quite standard clauses, and I think that they give effect to what I see as our shared intention that the President appoint the military ombudsman, that Parliament plays a role in that appointment.
Honourable Minister, is that what you would like to see Section 1 reading on Clause 5?
That's how we would see, like to see. Right?
Honourable Nana?
Thanks, Chair. Chair, can I just say that our legal team was not forthcoming this time around. You guys seem to have lacked guts, for a lack of a better word, of exactly advising what to do. Either Parliament should appoint this ombudsperson or the President should, because I mean, in the memorandum it says Parliament should play some role. Some role can mean anything, sir. And I'm saying, I think our guys, you know, we're not really forthcoming this time around. Chair, I would suggest that we as the committee should determine whether the appointment should be made by the head of state or by Parliament. Because if we continue to dilly dally on the issue, we may be sending mixed signals which could have devastating effects. I propose that as this committee we should first clear that where do we stand, because I mean saying some role that could mean anything. That's it. Honorable Daniels, thank you, Honorable Nana.
Thank you, Chair. I think I'm in agreement with Honorable Nana on this one. Only one, that this committee must decide exactly as to what it is. Whether the head of state has a point or what. From Honorable Manier, Chair, really, being a member of the political whatever, really, are we realistic and practical about all those things that you mentioned? The legal set here, it does not mean if you're a member of defense and therefore you cannot do your duties as an ombudsman. It does not work for or against for that particular person who will be appointed to do it or whatever. So really on the list of things that you mentioned, I totally not agree with all of those. I mean really, with all others, I mean they are standards of a sound mind, all, because I think somewhere in the act some of those are mentioned. But when you bring in political and all those, really, we're not being practical and considerate. And on the one of the ministry. But I think I'm agreeing with Honorable Nana that it's about time that as the committee decide whatever. Because we are going to take time to decide as to how. Failure for us having done that, then we will have to follow the processes of when nominations come into the House or into Parliament, whatever. Let's look at that as an option. And the appointment is supposed to be made, the names that are being put on the table in that process, which I cannot say, but let's look at that as an option if we are not decided to be taking a decision as the committee as to how the appointment must happen. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Member, we want to close the door. There was a question here by Honorable Lam, and you would like to see the role of the Parliament in the appointment. Now that is the path that we should choose. That if we want Parliament to play a role and also the President to play a role, there was a suggestion by a presentation here by Honorable Mania about that area. And then as to the qualification, I see you've gone to section A and section B already in your presentation, Honorable Mania. Now, there's nothing wrong in looking at that presentation, as Honorable Daniel says, some of the things are standard here. And then if you look at it, you may, Honorable Members may take out what they don't want or put in what they do not want. I think we need to move from on that footing. Honorable Mazia.
Yeah.
Chairperson, can we get normal practice in terms of, like, for instance, there was an appointment of the what is this other person? Public protector.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I think we should take a cue from the normal practice of the appointments, starting from the public protector. What is the normal practice?
Mm-hmm.
If the legal advisor can advise on that, I think we can take a cue from that.
Legal advisor? Thank you, ma'am.
Chairperson, if I may, I want to ask the question first. Do we want this ombudsman to have the same level of independence as the public protector or other chapter 9 institutions? Just want to clarify that answer before responding to the issue.
Can I hear?
Do we want this person, the ombudsman, to have the same level of independence as the public protector and other chapter 9 institutions?
Our point here was that we want Parliament to play a role in the appointment of the ombudsman. And the response that we expect from the legal advisors or whoever is in the team in regard of advice is what is the normal practice. We don't want a question. We want to know the practice, and then we'll decide from that.
Sorry, thank you.
The first is the president appoints on the recommendation of the National Assembly. That's the first is
that it also, if you say it's a normal practice, I take it you mean that is how it is done for Chapter 9 institution. All right? Thank you very much. Now, Honorable Mazia, the question is answered, and then I expect you to go on.
Yeah, no, Chairperson, I think the answer was too economic, in the sense that it is not addressing itself to the real question. And the real question was, in this instance, we want to know what is the role of Parliament. And we would have had a response that also advises us in regard to the question that in this Chapter 9 institutions, is it just the president just appointing without any involvement of Parliament? And the answer was not explicit in terms of that, except to be economic in the answer.
Did you get that?
Yes, and the issue at hand, what we have at the moment, the president is responsible for the appointment of the ombudsman. But the bill doesn't talk of the consultation, doesn't talk of the nomination process, it doesn't talk of the role of Parliament, its appointment. Now, I think it is up to the committee, if the committee wants to play a role in the appointment process of this person, then that can be done. We can redraft that clause in order to cater for that. But the president, as the head of the executive, must appoint. He must make the appointment. If you want the involvement of the parliament, he's going to make it on the recommendation of parliament. I think something is done along those lines in the draft from the Honorable Mr. Menner. I think he mentioned something along those lines.
Can we get a willing response to our question? Somebody who is more willing to answer this question as we would want it to be answered.
Okay. Honorable Mlambo.
Thank you, Chairperson. I honestly wanted to meet the follow up because the legal person, she doesn't want to go straight to the point. She says, this is what we need as the committee. She wants us to decide, and, you know, she must have come straight to say, no, the president appoints and this and that in terms of the appointment, you know. So,
okay, in terms of section chapter 9 institution, do we advise that the president appoints? Now, the committee, I'll come to you, ma'am. Now, it's us who are making this law as a committee. We decide as to whether we want it to be redrafted to include the role of parliament. I think that is the message that you put across to honorable members. Ma'am?
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to read section 193 of the Constitution, which deals with the appointment of Chapter 9 institutions. Subsection 4 states, the President, on the recommendation of the National Assembly, must appoint the Public Protector, the Auditor General, and members of the South African Human Rights Commission, Commission for Gender Equality, and Electoral Commission. Subsection 5 says, the National Assembly must recommend persons nominated by a committee of the Assembly proportionally composed of members of all parties represented in the Assembly and be approved by the Assembly by a resolution adopted with a supporting vote of at least 60% of its members of the Assembly if the recommendation concerned the appointment of the Public Protector and Auditor General or by the majority of the members of the Assembly.
I think you have answered the question. Now, it's up to us to decide as we take the route of as stipulated in the Constitution of Chapter 9 institution. That is, the committee must take that decision. Honorable Mazia.
Yeah, Chapter 10, we have taken a stand already, but all that was missing was the terminology in terms of how do we play a role. And it is clear in the Constitution how do we play a role. I've gone through the submission of Honorable Mania. I agree with part of it, but I find it too loaded. It has got too much information which I don't think we need it, or often. And because I've not consulted with my colleagues, I think we need to look at the submission and see how do we reduce it to be in line with what we would want to recommend. Right, that's fine. That's fine. If you look at the submission of Honorable Meneer, one, it deals with the subsection one as to who must appoint. And I think there is an agreement as to who must appoint. The president must appoint, and the parliament must also have a role that is done in terms of the process that is done for the appointment in Chapter 9 institution. But now, because his presentation involved all the sections, for instance, A, possess adequate knowledge of the Constitution, it was there in your presentation, Mania, already. B, has knowledge of experience in military and public administration, that was given over to the only difference here, in his presentation, it indicates that there should be a legal experience. I'm not sure as to whether you take legal experience as a prerequisite, Honorable Meneer.
that will be an area of discussion.
Chair, you're absolutely right to point out that variance between my proposal and the bill. And the Honourable Daniels also referred to her difficulty with my proposal that we exclude former members of the Defence Force being appointed as the military ombudsman. I mean, I don't want to, I mean, we will have to decide at some point who the best, if you like, category of person would be. My own view is that when it comes to the military ombudsman, as opposed to the deputy military ombudsman, that person, in fact, be a retired judge. What?
Say that again. That person?
My own view, Chair, ideally, and I've not made provision for this in my proposal, but ideally, I believe that the military ombudsman should be a retired judge.
Honorable Mazia?
Yeah. This element, Chairperson, this element then begins to say, even this argument that we have been raising, then will be watered, because if we recommend in the bill that that person should be a judge, we may as well say that it is correct that the president will appoint, because the president will then look at a retired judge and appoint that retired judge. So it will not necessitate a call for nominations and also a panel of people to select from, because all we will have to do is to say that judges will have to submit their interest to serve as ombudspersons. All right. Let us remind ourselves, let us recap again. I want us to go pound by pound here. On clause 5, there is an agreement on section 1. That is that the law advisors will redraft it to follow the trend that is followed in the appointment of Chapter 9 institution. Now, we do not have problem with that. We do not have problem with section A, that such a person should possess adequate knowledge of the Constitution, and then B, knowledge in military and public administration. Now, why don't we base our debate on knowledge rather than on profession, as you say, retired judge? Because I can see the trend is right here. There must be a knowledge of military, and then there must be Honorable Mazia.
Yeah, Chairperson, that is the reason I'm saying, you see, Honorable Menier is taking it too far now, because in his submission, explicitly, he also identifies those areas, knowledge of the constitutional and legal qualifications, and blah, 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 blah. But now, when you begin to be prescriptive, too much prescriptive, then it creates some problems. But even with the advert that the committee has to publish, it will also create some problems. That why are we still inviting when we know what we want? But if we speak to knowledge of what and blah 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 as it's in the bill now, I think then it gives us the authority and right
to participate. But once we say a judge, then technically it removes that ambition.
You, if you say a judge, you may as well say a retired general. So that is not the route, that is the route that you say we should not take. Right. Honorable Mania, Honorable Mkanadeli.
I don't intend to waste your time. All that I want to check, if firstly I agree with the suggestion that we should compare apples with apples. If we want to, we should compare apples with apples as it relates to the ombudsperson with other chapter 9 institutions. What I want to check, are we elevating this office to that level? And if we do, what are the constitutional imperatives, realizing that all other chapter 9 institutions are as a creation of our constitution? Where do we stand? I just want to get that information. I'm sorry for wasting.
Yes.
Chair, it won't be elevated to the same level as a Chapter 9 because that will require a constitutional amendment.
Yeah, yeah.
This will be a statutory body, and the powers that the body does have is those that are given to by Parliament.
Thank you, Governor.
Honorable, were you covered? Now, what do you say? Do we leave that? What do we say? That we say to B, have knowledge of or experience in military and public administration that was gained over a period of 10 years, because we have taken us to B already. What do we say? What? How do we amend B if we have to? Honorable Mayor.
Chair, I have a proposed amendment on the table, and that proposed amendment is here for everybody to read. But the deeper concern is this. I mean, my point was, and I don't want to distract our deliberations, I think that ideally the military ombudsman should be a retired judge. But given my proposal, I accept that there might be other better alternatives that Parliament would consider during the appointment process. So it's just simply, in my view, would be the ideal kind of person. But what I'm more concerned about, and that's why I am concerned about B, is that in my view, and I hold a strong view, and I'll explain why, the military ombudsman cannot be a former serving military officer. And I think that the legislation should explicitly prohibit that. Let me explain why. At its core, the military ombudsman will be investigating complaints that are unresolved in the chain of command. It is absolutely imperative that the military ombudsman be independent from the military chain of command. If the military ombudsman was a serving officer or a former serving officer, I believe that the military ombudsman would then fail the test of independence. Because first, the military ombudsman would then not, I think an ordinary person would have a perception, and this is the State versus Van Rooyen test if I recall correctly, there would be a public perception that the military ombudsman is not independent from the chain of command. That would be the first problem. The second problem would, given the strong military culture, I believe the military ombudsman will in fact not be independent from the chain of command. I think that it's important that the military ombudsman not be a serving or former officer in the Defence Force. That is not to say that the deputy ombudsman could not be a former serving officer. I could possibly live with that.
Honourable Member here, or we may not say that. Honourable Members, you need to be very careful. Whatever we do should also go in line with the Constitution, the rights of people.
Because if once you start that, you should not be former something. You must not, you mean that you should not be a former judge. They should not be a former teacher. They should not be a former whatever. And those are the citizens of this country. And they've got all the rights. Now, I must also warn you that independence in this case does not mean, it has got nothing to do with your former profession. It will depend on the adherence of the requirements of this bill when it becomes an act. So we cannot judge people on those bases, unfortunately, Honorable Minister, because it will make up to the committee to trust in the rights of the citizens of this country. Honorable Mazia.
Chairperson, in addition to that, we know that in our former Liberation Army, we have many people who are acting judges and who have been acting judges for quite some time now. And if that person submits a CV, it means we will have to advise them not to include their history in the CVs. And that chairperson cannot be allowed.
Honorable, I'm going to close on this, Mr. Honorable Mania.
Chair, I disagree with you strongly. I think your former profession has everything to do with the perception of independence. I'll give you a good example. I mean, it's precisely for that reason that it's very unlikely that a former member of the police service would be appointed as the head of the independent complaints directorate. I think it does have a bearing on your independence, and it certainly has a bearing on the perception of independence, which is a legal test of independence. That's the first point. The second point is, I mean, this is a point in law. If we precluded a military officer from, or former military officer, a former member of the Defence Force from applying to be the military ombudsman, I'm not sure that that would infringe their rights. The point in law, I'd be interested to hear the view from the legal advisor. But I don't think Parliament should be precluded from specifying who we think the, not necessarily the absolute ideal type of person should be, but certainly we should be able to specify who should not be able to apply for a position.
Before I explain myself, can I say on record that in no way am I casting aspersions and doubts on our judges. But it is a fact out there that some of our people in the Republic are not entirely convinced that in some cases our judges are neutral. I'm saying this in the context of what I said earlier, that I, as a person, I'm not casting aspersions and doubts on our judiciary. I'm saying this, Chairperson, because you see, Honorable Meniere wants to make all of us believe that a perception that judges are neutral or are not neutral. No. A perception that judges are not neutral does not exist. I'm saying he wants to make us to believe that because in his submission he says retired judges. I mean if you want to prescribe on people, you could say a retired advocate, a retired lawyer, and you'll have an endless list. And my proposal, Chairperson, is that
I agree with you that for us to be prescriptive, we would be in some way excluding other equally capable citizens of the Republic. And therefore, I think it would be appropriate for us to leave it as open as we can, so that anyone who feels that he or she is fit to discharge this kind of a responsibility be allowed to apply, and the committee would process the names. If we say we'll process the names and Parliament takes them to the President, or we do the appointment of ourselves. But I'm saying that the gist of my point, Chairperson, is that we may say a retired judge because we think that judges are neutral. But I can tell you not everyone in the Republic holds the same view. And then people are entitled to their opinion.
Thank you, Honorable Nana, Honorable Mukabate, Honorable Daniel.
I think you let us well. I think we agreed on 5-1 and on A we agreed. And we then said we want to check on section 9. Can I not propose that we jump, we leave it to the two advisors and we go to 4? Because I'm not expecting that we thought we were going to finish this bill today. We let the law advisors checking with section 9, checking our agreement on 5-1, 5-A, and then the rest we leave it to them. And then we go for 4.
Which 4 are you talking about?
5-4.
Oh, 5-4.
We take it from there as a collective. Otherwise, the rest.
What do you say we must leave out, Honorable Gabadeli B, on Section 5? What do you want to...
Section 5B, Section 2...
No, we are not there.
Section 5... That's what I'm saying.
No, we are not there. We are just on B now. We're talking about...
That's what I'm proposing, even if we are not there, because we have just received something that we need to take our minds out of our...
Honorable Mugabate, I'm leading this discussion off by clause. That's what I'm saying. I say now we are discussing D, and then we have not yet reached 2. Can we do that when we reach 2?
Okay, big, let's take it to the advisor. Because we're asking about it, and these documents are valid, all of them.
Let me look. There are some issues here, right here. They don't actually need legal advisors for us to understand that the citizens of South Africa have rights, equal rights. That's the core of our constitution. So that we don't have to go and go to the legal advisors for that. And then, as for I understand the argument by Honorable Meni about perceptions, but Honorable Nana, I think he has given us a guideline, a very good line. We may not sit here as lawmakers and think we can manage perceptions. Mm-hmm. Understand? Because if we are doing that, it means that, you see, the perception, in actual fact, the perception of white judges out there is that they are not neutral. That is the perception among the black communities. So that we must leave that to maybe the managers. There might be perceptions also about former servicemen. So we leave that perception here. As lawmakers, we must put an emphasis on our intention. Our intention is that we want this bill and we want this ombuds to be as independent as it could be. I think that is our intention. And then, as to whether that person becomes independent or not independent,
as the bill becomes an act, the perception will always be there. Some people might have perception of this ombudsman person is not independent. Some would say that it's independent. I think we must leave out the management issues to the management, and I dwell on our intention, and I understand our intention is the same, that we want the ombuds to be independent. Can we do that? Now, on B, you just have to amend B if you want to put in something else. Put it on it. Because here we say knowledge of experience in military and public administration that was gained over a period of 10 years. If there's anything that members want to put or to take out, do that, and then we'll discuss that. Honorable Daniel?
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, I do not agree with Honorable Meneer on the question of the judgment. There are a number of reasons. One has been cited. Two, in as much as the Chair has just advised us not to talk on perception, perceptions and assumptions will always be there. There are rights, there are interpretations, but also there are limitations in everything that we do. You correctly said a check. But also, what we need to take into cognizance is the fact that there is an oath of office of the ombudsman that the person will be required to take, so that particular person must be independent. And therefore, I also do not agree with the fact you must say no military test. Because if you say that, what are we saying? We're infringing on the rights of the citizens of this country. Like, for instance, the majority of the judges in this country, who are they? I'm talking majority. Who are they? Where have they been? I can answer that. That's very precious thing the Honorable Naina is talking to. They are white. They have served in the military. Honorable Mania is then therefore saying that they must not be allowed to serve. They served. In the prescription of that thing, going to the military. What are we saying? The majority of the members of the ASA in India currently are black. Do they believe that judge will do justice to their complaints? No. So, Chair, we cannot say, take the military out. We cannot ever say, restrictively say, a former judge. We need to open it so that we give a chance to all the citizens of this country who have the abilities and the capabilities, including those which are prescribed there, to have knowledge of the Constitution, military, administration, and everything we sign on that 5B. Thank you, Chair.
Okay. Can we now show I'm going to close with the new chairman of the state. No, maybe I will go forward.
Chair, I think the ruling party are distracted. And the distraction is the whole question of a retired judge. My statement was that in my view, I believe that a retired judge would be the ideal person for this position. Unlike many members of this committee, I have a high regard for the judiciary. But I do accept that there are good judges and there are bad judges. Anybody who watched E! News Channel this weekend will know that. But nowhere in my proposals do I say that the military ombudsman must be a retired judge. I simply say that the ombudsman must possess adequate knowledge of the Constitution and have a legal qualification and practical legal experience of at least 10 years. That's all. And members might want to know where that proposal comes from. It comes from the 2006 bill produced by this Parliament. Chairperson, please take before we proceed on this matter.
Okay.
Can you issue a statement on behalf of all of us who spoke on these charges, issued probably on behalf of the majority of this committee, that we have high regard for our judiciary, in case it goes out there and it gets misconstrued completely?
Thank you, Honorable Nana. Thank you, Chairperson. I haven't been around, but I wanted to say that if Honorable Menia is saying this person must not be a member or a former member of the Defence Force, I don't think that includes the non-statutory forces. They were not a defense force at any stage. And if that is what he is referring to SADF and SANDF, I would agree with him. That is excluding the non-statutory forces. Thank you.
Honorable Nana made a proposal that a statement should be issued.
No, not a formal statement. Yeah. Something from you. Or I can make it here.
Exactly. Oh, you're not making
it? I can, sir.
No?
Chairperson, before, you see, my worry is that already I get some insinuation that some of us have doubted the impartiality of our judiciary. And at least from where I'm sitting and from listening to what members of this committee were saying, they were talking about a perception that exists out there. Now, Chair, I wanted us to lay this matter to rest before we move on, because I know it may go out there that we, as the committee, have expressed our mixed feelings about the impartiality of our judiciary. That's why I wanted us to place it on record, on Hansard, that as a person, not for a moment that I doubt the impartiality of our judiciary.
Thank you very much, Honorable Nana. We did not even talk about the judiciary here, Honorable Members. We're talking about the perception people have on white judges. That's what we talked about. We didn't even touch the judiciary. I agree that should be the position of this committee. But the question still stands on B. How do we put B? Honorable Menia put in the legal qualification. That's the only difference that he came with. You want to say something, Malcolm?
Yes, on that, I was going to say perhaps we can consider having a paragraph or including that proposal in the bill. You know, having regard the fact that this person will deal with disputes, will deal with complaints. So maybe if he can have a legal background, that could help, Chairperson. So we can rephrase, we can provide for something along the lines of subsection 1A. Instead of we put a new paragraph that will say he must have a legal qualification and expertise. You know, we can add it there. Because this person will deal with complaints and disputes.
Legal qualifications. Honorable Market.
Thank you, Chairperson. I totally disagree with that. legal knowledge is enough, because legal qualification is something totally different. Well, rather, I mean, in any way, the ombudsperson will have either a legal section or something of that nature. The person himself or herself doesn't need to have qualifications. It's all objective.
So what you are saying, as much as we will not say a person must have a degree on public administration, we may not say a person must have a degree in law. Mazia, let's hear from you.
Yeah, no, Chairperson, I will be much comfortable if we on the area of knowledge of the Constitution, if we include legal what is it? If we include constitution and legal knowledge, then I will be happy with that arrangement.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. That's the proposal. We are talking about knowledge here. Legal knowledge, administration knowledge, military knowledge. Thank you very much. Honorable
Chair, how do you judge if somebody has legal knowledge? I have legal knowledge. I've redrafted the military ombudsman law. I don't have a legal qualification, and I've probably spent about 500 hours in UCT Law School's coffee shop eating donuts. That doesn't give me, that doesn't mean I'm legally qualified. How do you objectively measure that?
We should understand that there is a process here that is going to be followed. And that process is a process of people submitting their CVs and thereafter undergoing an interview for us to satisfy ourselves that, yes, this is the person that we want. So the area that Honorable Menyar is raising, it's an area where independently the president will just go and identify a person who has got legal constitution and legal knowledge without even looking at the qualifications of that person. Here we are talking about getting CVs of people, going through their qualifications and exercising our right to get in depth with their knowledge of our requirements. And Chairperson, I think that is adequate for us to stop and not raise any other arguments, because arguments of coffee shops and fish and chips, we also have them. And they hold no water in the arguments that we are raising here, because you can't in the CV state that you have acquired your legal knowledge from a coffee shop. Obviously, we are not going to consider you. You are a Mickey Mouse.
Honorable Mlambo, I understand. Masango. Was it Masango?
Chairperson, definitely, if I wanted to say something.
Okay.
I'm also not comfortable if I'm just going to say people with legal knowledge. I mean, it's a lot of us who have legal knowledge. We have to have a qualification, then that will show that. As Mlambo is saying, he's saying we're going to look at the qualification. But what are we going to look at the qualifications who are not looking for legal qualification? Are we going to look for any qualification and say, this is qualification? If we are going to look for legal qualification, then we need someone with legal qualification.
Why don't you look for somebody with administrative qualification or military qualification? That's the question that I'm asking you. Chairperson, why is he not waiting for the period where interviews will be conducted and argue that this person, I'm not satisfied with the qualifications presented by this person, rather than argue now that our description of the person we want is this description, when we know that what do we want ourselves. And what we want ourselves will be determined by the interviews and also submissions of CVs that will be at our disposal. And it is the only time that we will begin to make this judgment. But now we are making judgments and we want to be prescriptive before even we start with the work, which simply says, Jefferson, that this person is a stillborn person.
Thank you very much, Honorable Benjamin. Honorable Nini and Honorable Mulambo.
Chair, ultimately, I think what we do agree on, the military ombudsman, whoever he or she may be, must be an eminent person and must be well qualified. This is a very, very important position in the Department of Defense. And I, for the record, am not convinced that we've set the bar high enough. That's the first question, the first problem. And the second is, and we'll come back to this argument when I do my proposals for amendments to the next clause, I think we need to consider very carefully the question of the military ombudsman being a former member of the Defence Force. I think that does raise a question about independence, and we have to bear in mind that the mischief that this person will be investigating will be primarily unresolved grievances by the military command, which this person, if he or she was a military officer, is likely to have been partially responsible for.
Chairperson, we cannot go into an interview not knowing what we want. We just go in there, we'll decide there what we want. If we go into an interview, it must be something that is listed there. And if we we are going to get a lot of applications. We should be knowing from this document which type of people or which qualification are we going to, so that we can shortlist people. But if we go there and go and decide when we look at the people and say, yes, this one, no, we must have something that we are going to decide on.
Yes, I see that this committee will write an advert now. I suppose a normal advert for this position would say that the applicant must have, what is it, they call it M+3 or M+4, meaning that you must have matric and a degree, and maybe a postgraduate degree. Whether it's a military degree, administration degree, or a legal degree, will not matter anymore as if it is followed by with knowledge, legal knowledge, and military knowledge, and knowledge of the Constitution. I think that's what you're going to do. Honorable Mazia?
Yeah, no, Chairperson, I suspect Honorable Daniel is informed that the President intends appointing me for that position.
it would be a shocking appointment.
No, Honorable Mania will not leave this committee.
Like, can we note what Honorable Mania said, and then we continue to say that we add legal knowledge in this process. Raidu, and then we go on to 2. On 2, that is section 2. Adequate knowledge of Constitution, A. Well, that's B. Yeah. Same as 5. But why is it same of... Why do they have to repeat themselves? Does the like this Honorable Mulambo?
realize that there is a slight difference on the period of
oh, but there is the minister, the deputy. Okay.
I was wondering how one actually arrived at 8.
Oh, yeah, this is the deputy. That's B, and then we go to section 3, holding office. What do we say? 5 years renewable, what Mazia, honorable?
Yeah, no, Chairperson, we would prefer that it be 7 years non-renewable. Not 5.
7 years non renewable. Agreed. No matata. Section 4. And then we consistency there, the ombudsman should be ombuds. Then, okay, if you agreed on that, Honorable Mayor?
Chair, I propose in my amendments that we include a subclause C under 4, which reads as follows: such remuneration may not be reduced, and such terms and conditions may not be adversely altered during the term of office of the Ombudsman and Deputy Ombudsman. That is consistent with the advice we received from the Parliamentary Legal Advisor, and the language is taken from the 2006.
Honorable Mania, you're talking about 4C.
Yes.
Okay. No, we'll come to that. What do we say about A? We agreed on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then B? The ombudsman on the consistency, the ombuds. Honorable Mazia.
Yeah, no, Chairperson, the B would prefer that we remove the 85% and maybe we make an alteration in terms of the 85% to say in such terms as may be determined by the president.
That is another amendment on the deputy ombuds. Agreed? Honorable Mania?
Chair, this again speaks to, I think, independence. If the President has discretion during the term of office for 7 years to alter the terms and conditions of the Deputy Ombuds problem, I think that may impinge on the Ombudsman's independence. We need an objective test, and during the 7 years, which I agree with, the terms and conditions and the remuneration may not be decreased or reduced.
Honorable Member,
Chairperson, I'm not sure if we are noting that the Deputy Ombudsman, the appointment of the Deputy Ombudsman and the appointment of the Ombudsman are going to be different, because what is the period that is determined here is the period of the Ombudsperson, not of the Deputy Ombudsperson. The Deputy Ombudsperson's period of office is not determined here, which necessarily suggests that the 7 years that we are suggesting for the ombudsperson is the 7 years with an understanding that there is no continuity in that office, and that continuity will emerge from the appointment of the deputy, who will not then be contractual.
the tribunal, the legal advisors and the advisors, what are the trends on the deputy ombuds? Contract worker as part of staff or what?
Chair, I think what Honorable Magia just said is correct. You will note from the bill that there is no specific term linked for the deputy ombudsman. So the idea was that the ombudsman becomes, the deputy becomes part of the office. So the term applies to the ombudsman. So there's a difference between how we treat the deputy and how we treat the ombudsman himself, because he's expected to provide continuity in the office. But the top will be changing after 5 years or 7 years, depending on whatever period is proposed by certain members. So there's a difference and the level of independence that you will expect from the ombudsman and what you will expect from the deputy is a completely different matter, because the head is the ombudsman himself.
But I ask, what is the trend in other the other institutions?
Well, sure, what comes to mind is the public protector. You will recall we had the change of guard in the public protector. There is a new public protector, because the public protector office has a specific term, which is 7 years. But you will know that the deputy is still there, although the term of the previous public protector still remains. So he is part of the office of the public protector for continuity.
Thank you very much. Honorable Mania.
Thank you, Chair. The Honorable Mazia is absolutely correct about the term of office, and I apologize if I missed that. But still, I think my argument holds. The salary of the Deputy Ombudsman must be objectively set. Now, I don't think that it should be at the discretion of the Presidency, and I don't think that it should be easily reduced or tampered with. That's why I would just simply prefer that the salary be objectively set. Now, if you don't agree with 85%, I mean, I can live with 100%. It doesn't matter. But I think it needs to be objective and law.
Okay. How do we craft it, Honorable Mlambo?
I'm not sure. Thank you, Comrade Chair. I'm not sure here if Honorable Mayner is talking about the ombud, not the deputy. The 85% that was spoken about before, the suggestion of this concession that Honorable Mazia is talking about, which should be determined by the President. Can't we leave it at that? Because there's some kind of confusion in terms of the deputy Umba's continuation in the office. He doesn't have, he or she have a contract. So that salary can be determined by the President.
I'll come to you, Honorable Mania. My understanding is that Honorable Mania does not necessarily disagree with Mazia's rating of 85%. But Honorable Mania says that it must be objectively determined. Now, what our point of discussion was, what will be the objective determination? Honorable Mazia, Honorable Magi?
Yeah, Chairperson, it's normal practice that in departments you have got the DG, you have got the DDG, you have got what. Obviously, this person may possibly be at the level of the DDG, or maybe at the level of the what do they call it, chief director's position, something like that. You see, so when we say determine, we are saying that this person will be given a title either of a DDG or either of a chief director, but it will be a position which will be in line with the discretion of appointing people. Like, for instance, because you can't have a DDG earning the same salary as the DG,
the DG will obviously have a bigger salary. And we are saying the determination of the 85% of the ombudsman, we are saying that we are not, it's not in line with our position.
Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. I had a question along those lines. Where does the staff of the ombudsperson belong? They belong to the Public Service Commission. Or if that is the case, then I'm answered by what my comrade has just said. Thank you.
That's right. But that, then how do we craft it? We need to have a way of crafting it. Honorable Mayor?
Yeah, Chair, again, I think what's at issue here is independence, and my point is that we need to find a way of objectively setting the Deputy Ombudsman's remuneration. The Honorable Maziers might offer us a solution, and perhaps we could craft a clause which would say that the salary of a Deputy Ombudsman must be equal to a Deputy Director General, for example. That might be a way of objectively defining what it is that he or she should earn in the, by the way of salary. I mean, we could perhaps look at something like that.
Can we thank much? Honorable benchmark.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. I think we are moving in circles here. My little understanding is that the Act is actually saying that we, as we are sitting here, surely we are going to interview the deputy. If we were to put it practically, is that after the appointment of the ombudsperson, it will be the decision of the ombudsperson and maybe the president or whoever, or what type of staff do they need. And maybe they are going to determine or the deputy would be at this level. So we can't be talking about the remuneration of the deputy ombudsman because we've got nothing to do with that. I think it's irrelevant. And maybe if we could move forward, they will determine whatever level, and the level will determine the remuneration. Everything will sort itself out. Thank you.
But are we especially saying that we leave it to the President and the Minister of Finance? Honorable Day. Okay. Then can we move on? You're raising your hand, Honorable Minister.
Chair, this is not about remuneration. This is about the independence of the military ombudsman. If the president adjusts, if the president or any, frankly, member of the executive can arbitrarily adjust the remuneration of the deputy ombudsman, that would impinge on the independence of the institution. All I'm saying is we need to find an objective, if you like, clause setting out the remuneration of the military, the deputy military ombudsman. And we've not, so far as I am aware, we've not done that.
Honorable Onana?
Chairperson, very soon we will be discussing conditions of employment for the secretary of the military ombudsman. If this committee would allow us to get to such detail, I'm afraid we will be spending much time on what I see as trivial issues. Chairperson, can I just be protected, please? Chair, he knows himself. Chairperson, I think it's sufficient for us to address
in more detail the conditions and terms of engagement of the ombudsman. And honestly, sir, if we go to the deputy ombudsman, what will stop us from deliberating on the PM, the PA, the researchers, if there will be research and so on and so on. I think we've done justice with this one, sir.
Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to rule on it. I'll give you an opportunity. Can you do that now? Say what you say now, Honorable Mayor.
Chair, just in response to the Honorable Member, we are not dealing with a trivial issue. We are dealing with the independence of the military ombudsman, which is the heart of the issue. That's the first thing. The second thing is there is a difference between the deputy military ombudsman and a PA in the military ombudsman office. And the difference and the importance of the deputy was pointed out by the Honorable Malia. The deputy will be the continuity in the office between appointments of the military ombudsman. He or she will the person occupying that position will be a very important person, and it's imperative that if the military ombudsman is going to be independent, that person be protected. And one of the ways of protecting that is to make sure that the remuneration package is objectively set and not reduced arbitrarily.
Honorable Member, CEO. Honorable Nazir.
Yeah.
Chairperson, if we go back to the draft bill such as 85%, and I think it is objective enough for us to say the terms. Obviously, the person who will be appointing this person is the person who will know the responsibility of that person, as the Honorable Mayor is trying to outline. But what we should avoid to do, Chairperson, we should avoid to think that a salary is an incentive of guarantee partiality to individuals. Because it is not a salary that decides partiality of an individual. It is credibility of that person. And I want to ask you, Chairperson, that in this respect, you make a ruling on this matter and agree with us that we don't think whether it's the president or the minister or the minister of finance that they will overlook the position of this deputy ombudsperson in relation to the salary that will be given to the ombudsman. The salary that will be going to be given to the ombudsman is obviously going to give a guide of what determination they should come to when deciding the salary of the deputy ombudsman, and taking into consideration, Chairperson, that on a yearly basis, this person is obviously going to get a salary adjustment because this person is not contracted. All these other sectors should not be left out without being realized. And I want to plead through you, Chairperson, that we plead with Honorable Manier that this advice is sufficient enough for whoever is going to decide over the salary of this person to think properly and reward this person as it will be expected. Thank you. Honorable Daniel? Honorable members, I think we have debated enough on this matter. Maybe what we should do, let's leave it, because the position of the ombuds and the deputy ombuds is slightly different from what you presented here. We leave it to the president and the minister of finance, as is stated in the bill.
All right. Then we can go to. The president in consulting here in the bill. That would be the president, the deputy import. The president. We are going to follow the route that is taken in the appointment of chapter 9 constitution. Then they will redraft it and bring it to us. Thank you very much. The section five. Yeah. The ombuds and deputy ombuds may at any time resign by submitting a written notice to the president at least 2 months prior to the intended demarcation of office. Honorable Melia?
Chair, I wanted to go back to sub-clause 5.4, where I proposed the insertion of a new C. Which would read as follows.
We passed it. A new C. What? At 4, subsection 4.
5,
subsection 4. Yeah. Honorable Mania wanted to insert C, remember. And then what was that C? I said he should wait until we deal with the area of the sections.
C reads as follows. Such remuneration, and here we're referring to the remuneration of the ombudsman and the deputy ombudsman, such remuneration may not be reduced and such terms and conditions may not be adversely altered during the term of office of the ombudsman and deputy ombudsman.
Do we have any problem with that insertion? No. Honorable Nana?
Chairperson, I don't have a problem with it, but can I check with my legal knowledge is letting me down a little bit. Can I check with the legal gurus? What does the Labor Relations Act and other related acts like your conditions of service say about reduction and altering, adversely altering conditions of engagement of a person?
I think, Chair, it's similar to what is being proposed, that you may not reduce somebody's salary while he's in the post, unless it's a punitive measure. But ordinarily, salary should be guaranteed. You may not adversely, unless you have downgraded the post. But while I'm in the post, it's an unfair practice, unfair labor practice.
Your next question will be as to whether we put it in the bill or not.
Chair, this once again goes to the whole question of the independence of the military ombudsman. Based on the advice which we received from Parliament, I have inserted or I have proposed this amendment. I think that in respect of the ombudsman and deputy ombudsman, which hold high office in a very important institution, they need belts and braces, added protection from the arbitrary interference by the executive in their remuneration.
Honorable Dunham.
Then what happens to the ex that the president is talking to? Therefore, it means not in use or we are not using it. Is this motivated or informed by the fact that it has been done? It was not considered what? Can we be enlightened?
In terms of the process, legal advisors, in terms of is there anything wrong if the committee put that in or anything wrong if it doesn't put it out? Is there anything, does it impact on the process?
Chair, this clause, you will find that in most of these acts, in all these legislation that have already passed, you will find it has become standard.
Okay.
Because it's linked to the issue of independence, that the executive should not, when it is no longer pleased with the incumbent, go and reduce the salary to encourage him to leave. So it's very much linked to the issue of independence, but it's not something I would want to.
So, okay, it's fine. Then we can put in the clause. We can insert the clause as seen, eh?
I think I'll object. Why should we put it in there? Because it doesn't make any sense. We're just making the deal itself bulky unnecessarily. Because the clause itself doesn't change anything. Why should we put it in? It's covered already. It might even give us a problem if it allows the authorities that may be to reduce the salary as a punitive measure. If we put this, then it might stop that happening. And that is why shouldn't it happen if that is something? Why shouldn't it happen as a punitive measure, like any other person? So if you put it in here, it means punitive measures can no more be used on the remuneration. I should think we might just drop this thing and go forward. If the standard is there, why should this one be Jesus Christ?
Honorable Mike, my understanding is that this clause is a standard clause in every piece of legislation that is done, not like it's standard somewhere. Every piece of legislation pertaining to this matter, they always use that clause. So we have a good benchmarking. We don't lose anything if we do.
Did I understand it for a standard result and every public servant who adheres to this? That is my understanding. If that is the case, then what is the case?
Didn't you, let's get it right, did you say standard in terms of every piece of legislation we do, it will always include this clause?
Yeah, the point I was making was, I'm a civil servant. I applied for a post at a certain level. The employer cannot reduce my salary unless I've committed a misconduct. If I'm found guilty of a misconduct, they may even take my salary for a month or whatever month they may take. But as a standard rule, in employment relationship, is that the salary cannot be reduced arbitrarily. But I'm saying then again, in the context of similar legislation where you're creating an office of this nature, like the public protector, because this clause, I know for a fact, comes from the Public Protector Act and the 2006 version. Because of the issue of independence, there is always the legislature always inserts that clause just to reinforce the issue of independence. That when you are displeased, you don't go and change. So a person at least is guaranteed not only the term, the remuneration as well, that during that period it remains the same. So it's just to reinforce the whole issue of independence. But it has become also standard in these kinds of institutions. You can look at all these pieces of legislation that deal with Chapter 9 institution, you are likely to find a clause. So that's why here we're saying I'm not unduly bothered about it. I'll be comfortable if we leave it in. I will be comfortable if we take it out. I don't have any particular.
Are we then persuaded by the legal advice of the trend? Okay, that's fine. It's agreed. No, it's agreed. Then let's go to, okay, we are done with you. Then we will put it there. And then we go to the section 5. Eh? Any problem with that? None? No, 5? No problem? Agreed? 6? Consistency must also be the ombudsman. Honorable Menier?
Chair, I'd like to propose an amendment And I'd like to propose that clause 6 be deleted and replaced with the following words: the ombudsman or deputy ombudsman may be removed from office on A, the grounds of misconduct, incapacity or incompetence, a finding to that effect by the Joint Standing Committee on Defence, and the adoption by the Assembly of a resolution calling for the removal of the ombudsman or deputy ombudsman. A resolution of the National Assembly concerning the removal of the ombudsman or deputy ombudsman must be adopted with a supporting vote of the majority of members of the Assembly. Again, Chair, I think it's a fairly standard clause. It's consistent with my proposal for the appointment of the military ombudsman, but I'm sure, given the fact that the majority of members on the committee have an appetite for an appointment mechanism based on the appointment of the public protector, we might have asked the legal advisors to advise us how the public protector can be removed from office.
Deputy.
No, Chair, I'm grateful to the legal advisor. That's an omission on my part. Okay.
Okay, so you omit deputy, and then it will be in line with the appointment. Because it was also about the rule of parliament again, eh? The process is the same as that. Members? We have this? On this note?
It's like the other something labor related to the next question.
Parliament in the appointment of the ombudsman. Honorable Daniel?
The process. I'm interested in the process of that finding. Is he suggesting that we overrule that process as parliament? Surely, even though we've been part of the appointing, there are offices and stakeholders in place who can make that finding, so that that makes it possible for the president to make that finding. That's what I want to understand, that process.
Nana? Oh, no, it's working, sir. Chairperson, the legal advice we got from, I think it's state law advisors or parliament legal advisors, in the memorandum, it attempts to guard against misuse of office by the president in an event he or she doesn't like the ombudsperson anymore. And Chairperson, if I think as the committee we must take full responsibility. If we say the ombuds should be appointed in line with how other Chapter 9 institutions are appointed, we can't leave it halfway, Chair. Let's further complete it to say, because the Constitution clearly states how the President can remove a commissioner or a chairperson of a Chapter 9 institution. I want to propose, Chairperson, that as the committee, having adopted such a model of appointment, to me it stands to reason that we should actually complete the cycle to say the same process of appointing the Chapter 9 institutions and the same process of removing them from office should be applicable to the military ombuds. Thank you. Honorable Mazia, are we taking that approach, Honorable Members? Yeah. So then we are going to, we are done with this part, we are going to break for lunch and then we will come back at 2, let's come back at 2 and complete the outstanding clauses, Honorable Members. 2, let's synchronize our watch. I don't know where it's lunch. Oh, go to lunch. Oh, yeah. No. No, don't eat your lunch. So we'll come, let's come back at 2, Honorable Members. It's 5 to 1 now. So you have to.